Welcome to episode 10 of the Cold Fear Podcast. I'm your host, Aaron Mulkey. Spring has officially sprung here in Wyoming, and it's almost 70 degrees today and snowing tomorrow, so figure that one out. But got a good one for you guys today. I got John Free on the podcast, and if you haven't heard of John's name, he hasn't been super active the last few years, but he does have some very notable ascents in the Alaska range and really took smash and grab to a whole nother level back when he was super active and had a full-time job. And this conversation, really for anybody that's got, that has a full-time job, really trying to figure out how to balance big trips, you know, going places to go climb, whatever it might be, and how do you do that? And, you know, John did it very successfully in Alaska. In fact, he had 18 trips to the range in a matter of 10 years. He had 16 summits. And of those 18 trips, 16 of those were smash and grab, okay? And smash and grab is really the term used for watching the weather, getting that weather window, and literally maybe flying to Alaska on a Friday, flying into the range Friday afternoon, maybe Saturday morning, and being back at work on Monday or Tuesday. Literally smash and grab. He has 10 first ascents. And some of those first ascents are winter first ascents, and some of those first ascents are new routes. So that's pretty impressive with 18 trips, 16 of those smash and grabs, 16 summits, and 10 first ascents of some shape or form. Very impressive to talk through that. He's also one of the, back in the Jim Jones days, John worked with Mark Twight, was one of the first certified coaches, disciples, if you will. So he's got a lot of information to share on that. Now works with Evoke Endurance. Really just a good conversation. I've been friends with John for a very long time, back when he was actually learning how to climb Water Ice 3. But his whole kind of, I guess, theory on smash and grab and how he executed that was pretty always impressive to me. I'm really curious if anybody knows who kind of created the term smash and grab. I kind of threw it out there as something that John kind of ran with. I don't know that John necessarily created the term smash and grab, but if anybody has information on that, that would be interesting to know who created the term smash and grab. And I think smash and grab has been probably happening for years with lots of people out there. But John did it very successfully in a very short period of time. And consistently in a short period of time, over 10 years, and successfully. So sit down, enjoy this one. Alaska is on everybody's mind right now. I know a lot of people are heading up there to go climb. And if you're jealous of that buddy that's heading out to go spend 2 weeks, well, you don't always have to spend 2 weeks. And John will kind of talk through that. And in fact, I did a smash and grab a few years ago on Huntington. I think we flew into Anchorage Friday night, landed on the glacier Saturday morning, bivvied Saturday night. Sunday, we were kind of descending that evening, and I was back in Anchorage and working on Monday afternoon. So pretty impressive, all about learning how to read those weather windows and things like that. But here you go. Let's get into it. I'll just stop talking here. So let's get into the conversation. Thanks for listening. All right, welcome to the podcast, John Free. And for anybody that has not heard John Free's name, John Free, I got a few things here to share about John Free. One, he introduced me to my wife. Two, he is basically the guy that kind of created smash and grab. Yep, we're just going to throw that out there. So if you've heard of smash and grab, John kind of basically came up with that idea and ran with it. We're going to get into that a little bit. And then three, through that smash and grab efforts, he also became the first Jim Jones certified instructor, disciple, whatever you want to call it. Did I miss anything there?
I don't know if you missed anything. I feel like you stretched some.
That's all right. That's all right. That's what podcasts are good for.
All right.
And then through smash and grab, 18 trips to Alaska, 16 successful summits, and 10 first ascents of some sort, shape, or form.
First ascent or first winter ascent.
First winter ascent.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that's pretty impressive, that many trips. I mean, I just interviewed Jack Tackle, and his was like
what do you have, 30 plus, 35 trips to Alaska, 36, I think, something like that. I can't remember.
Well,
18 is pretty good.
It's we have no right to even consider me to be anywhere in the realm of Jack Tackle.
This is true. there's not, speaking of Alaska and alpine climbing, there's not many people that you actually can put into that same bucket. There's no doubt.
I'm kind of a one trick pony that I figured out something that kind of worked for me and was able to make it produce some success over the years. And Jack's the man. And the fact that I'm sitting here on the microphone is a little awkward, to say the least. But it's your podcast, man.
Hey, I get to choose who gets to come on. So that's the way it works. And then I'd be curious, I bet 18 trips to Alaska, you probably have the record for the least amount of days sitting on a glacier, though.
I don't know.
We don't have to call records here, but I bet they're, as we get into the smash and grab stories here, not many days.
With the exception of, I think, so my first trip to Alaska in 2009, with none other than another friend of your podcast, Doug Shepherd. Shout out Dr. Shepherd.
Dr. Shepherd.
I think that was 5 days on the glacier, and that was kind of when we started to maybe think about things a little. But all the trips after that, with the exception of two trips to the Wrangell St. Elias, I think I essentially would spend, 2 nights on the glacier.
Yeah. So very few.
Yeah.
Okay. So before we get into that, let's talk about how we first met, because you told me the story before we jumped on here, and I didn't even remember that I did it. Maybe I somehow just forgot about it.
Blocked it out.
I blocked it out.
Because someone might have actually gotten a first ascent in the South Fork that wasn't associated with you.
That may have been. And I told a small lie in order to try to keep it. Yeah, maybe. So, go for it.
God. So, 2007. Been climbing, ice climbing a few years at that point. One of my climbing partners at the time was a student at Montana State, Mr. Brian Schmitz, or as I affectionately,
Mr. Schmitz.
Yes, Mr. Schmitz, or the youth, as I affectionately referred to him. Shout out, Mr. Schmitz. He sent me an email or whatever. I don't even know, this 07, right? So yeah. Ancient times. He's like, Cody's in good. Let's go. We got to go. And so jumped on the plane, flew to Bozeman. We drove down, and first time coming to Cody for me. I'd only really climbed in Highlight at that point and kind of didn't know what to expect. And instantly it was like, oh God, what have I done? Schmitz, what have you done to us? And the first day we did Sendero. And then walked over to Moratorium, and on the walk over, walked through, from what I could tell, was essentially a massacre of some deer from a bunch of like wolves. Like there was bits of deer left laying that had been eaten. And I was like, oh, this isn't Highlight anymore. Still managed to climb the Moratorium and was just like, oh my God, this place is amazing. We were staying in, at the time it was still the AAC bunkhouse.
Oh yeah.
Cause I hadn't met you yet. Feeling cool, you know, did the moratorium. And so the next day that was a four. So we're like, okay, let's step it up a little, and went and did, the one hitter the next day, which we'd kind of saw, looked like it was kind of in, we couldn't tell. And we went up there. And the pillar actually hadn't touched down. And so the Schmitz, the youth, somehow managed to dry tool up the chimney in the back and sent it like on, those old crappy original Petzl Ergos. You remember with the orange handles?
Oh yeah. Yeah.
And a pair of Black Diamond switchblades.
Oh my word.
The second worst cramp one ever created. we can talk about the worst one ever later. So we climbed it and took it to the chains, and we're like, oh man, we're cool. Like Cody Five, you know? And so back at the bunkhouse, looking at the guidebook, what do we do tomorrow? Oh, let's just did a five. Let's do a five plus. And so we go up Deer Creek to do Bitches Brew and climb the approach pitches, climbed and got up to the five plus and looked at it. And we're like, oh, maybe we're not so cool. like I was like, I didn't know ice could be so steep. Like, I just remember us sitting there and staring at it and like, just like coming up with excuses of why we were too scared. And so, cause that was essentially like, we got skunked that day. Like, what do we do? Like, oh, let's drive into town. Schmitz was basically almost out of PBR. And we needed to stock up. And so we went into town and we went to your shop. You still had the shop.
Oh, yeah.
And met you. And I totally skipped over the important part.
Yeah, the important part.
So the important part was, is we came down, and if you know Bitches Brew, you know that it's a bit of a hike back into Deer Creek. And if you've ever done the approach, if you've ever done anything in Deer Creek, you know, it's a little intense out of the parking lot.
It's a 1,000 feet gain right out of the parking lot.
It's a nice warm up.
Switchbacks basically immediately.
Get the blood pumping. It's not walking downhill to the ice park. That's for sure.
No.
And so we were that far back in the canyon and we were like, well, we're back here. Let's see what else we see. And so we hiked up the trail a little further and we totally saw what looked like an ice line. And we were like, what's that? So got back to the car, checked the guidebook. There's nothing past Bitches Brew. What could that be? And so we went into town, get Schmidt some PBRs, and went to the shop and we're like, let's ask the mayor of the South Fork, you know, the oracle, the one who knows all, Aaron Mulkey, like, what is there anything that's been done past Bitches Brew? And so that's when I first met you and we said, hey, Aaron, is there anything past Bitches Brew? And instantly, with not even a pause, you were like, oh yeah, you know, Stan Price did some stuff back there. It's not in the guidebook, but yeah, I'm sure like Stan did it. I forget what he named it instantly. Like, which is another person I hope you get on this podcast.
Oh yeah, someday. I'm working on him.
Stan Price, which after climbing One Arm Bandit, I will say, I hope that you can ask him about that one.
Oh yeah, that's the best story.
It makes my butthole pucker
just a little bit. Yeah.
So
yeah.
So we believed you, for the most part.
Yes.
And proceeded to, I think we climbed, God, what did we do? I think we did a few more routes here and then we left cause we had to get back to Bozeman cause I had to catch my flight back, but we did Cali ice on the way back. And then I flew home after like 5 days, just destroyed. And it was an amazing trip. And so fast forward a year to 2009, somehow I think Jojo, another friend of the pod, shout out Jojo, was desperate for competitors in the icebreaker they used to do in Highlight at the Ice Fest. And he was like, John Free, can you be one of the competitors? And I was like, oh no. And so I ended up in the icebreaker and, how they used to run that was it was a local matched with a non-local and you essentially had to climb as many pitches as you could in the canyon in 9 hours.
Oh.
And you just had to hammer. And, for whatever reason, unfortunately, maybe it was rigged. I got matched with Schmitz that year. And so
really? Oh, you got matched with Schmitz.
Yeah. Well, okay. He got screwed, not me. I was like, yeah. Sweet. I got a good partner that knows me. But we did the breaker in 9. Somehow we got third place, which is a little bonkers. I think we did a bunch of questionable tactics. Like Jojo had a rule. You couldn't solo. You had to place at least one screw per pitch. And so we would place the screw standing on the ground and then proceed to solo the pitch while the partner cleaned the screw.
Oh my
while
God.
Belaying. And so you just like, it was just like climb as fast as you could. And so we had a good event, but the best part of this, and I'm being long winded here, is that I met Stan was there. And so Schmitz and I cornered Stan at one of the activities and we're like, hey, did you ever do anything past Bitches Brew and Deer Creek and Cody? Like, Mulkey was saying you did something up there. And he's like, nope, never did anything past Bitches Brew. And we were like, motherfucker, Mulkey totally bullshit us. And then that's when we knew that you were like trying to keep us from getting a first ascent in your turf, your home, your spot. So, yeah.
Oh my God.
So that's the story when I met you and you proceeded to lie to me.
And I think I remember after you told me that we ended up getting a bunch of snow. And so it was like, I'm not going to go back there. It's just going to be way too much work. And yeah.
Well, karma intervened and said, you will not get this FA after lying to these nice young kids that want to just try and climb a new route and maybe add their name to the guidebook that might be published someday.
Yeah, I might have been a little bit protecting something there. Maybe. I don't know. Yeah. So, and then you ended up, because you guys ended up coming back the next year.
So we came back after finding out that it, in fact, was unclimbed. We came back in 2009 and we almost weren't going to do it because it was like minus 10. It was like brutal cold. And I think you had to work that day.
Yeah.
Because we were like fine with you coming.
Which is funny that you found out that I lied to you, but then you're still like, hey, do you want to come?
Well, you know, I mean, you're one of the, like, I say this, I should pause here. Like, if you haven't met Aaron, he truly is one of the nicest, most generous, kind people I've slept in this house. I'm sitting here in the Cold Fear podcast studio that for some reason doesn't have a handleless microwave.
I know that's really weird.
If you know anything about Aaron, if you've known him for a while, you know the secret to Water Ice 5 is a handleless microwave. If you don't know
how many people have been to the house and remember the handleless microwave, the crimper microwave.
Oh man. Well, if you don't know about it, you should come to the Wyoming Ice Festival and ask him what the secret to Water Ice 5 is. And he will tell you and explain to you the handleless microwave,
the crimper microwave.
Exactly.
Crimp all year on that microwave.
It's why I still struggle with fives.
Yeah.
I need to break the handle off my microwave.
And for anybody listening, the crimper microwave was basically this. Well, at that point in time, my house was pretty much a climber flop house.
That's putting it mildly.
Yeah, I mean, it was pretty rough. In fact, I think I remember like tearing the carpet out of the place. And I was like, you know what? The wood seems fine. Let's just paint the plywood. And so I think I painted all the plywood in the house brown or something. That was freaking awesome. And then, but there were in the kitchen, there was, we had the microwave and I think I bought it and the handle was broken. And I was like, but it still worked. And so I didn't have any money to buy a new microwave. And so you had to do this crimp underneath the microwave with both hands. You couldn't do it one handed.
Yeah, it was a very well sealed. Like the force required to open the door was very high and you had to really like, it was like an undercling,
totally,
but a crimp. Like it was like, I don't know, half a pad maybe.
Yep. Yeah.
And you had to reef on that thing.
Yeah. So if anybody's out there, try opening your microwave without the handle and you'll understand it's very, very key. And the house was quite the flop house at that point in time.
Do you remember those Irish guys you had?
Oh, yeah. They're from the UK or England. And that's a crazy story because I was like, my word, there was like, I think those guys just sent me an email. And there were like three of them that were coming to the US. They'd never climbed in Cody. And I didn't have any partners. So I'm like, hey, dude, you guys want to stay at my place? And they came and
they show up with a bunch of like hexes.
Oh, yeah. They came like, up, they came with all kinds of, and they
like Scottish shit.
They were some party freaking dudes. They got after it. We got after it, but man, they were some partiers and that was a good time. But
good
at that time, point,
good times. Yeah,
there's lots of stories of that era, but, at that
perhaps for another podcast,
Yeah. There's a lot too many stories that maybe shouldn't even be shared on the podcast, but, at that time, the house was quite the flop house for climbers. So I didn't have any partners. So I was desperate to like, if you were going to come to town and you communicated with me, I was like, hey, stay at my place because that's how I could lock down a partner.
And it's why I said earlier, and I'll say it again, you're extremely generous and have done so much for the South Fork, including, you know, letting people stay at your house, telling them conditions, doing all of these things that, you know, is why the South Fork is so great now.
Yeah.
So,
yeah. Well, I appreciate it. And if you hear a dog rolling around, Goose is in here playing with some tat that I recovered from the hills yesterday, and she loves the recovered tat. There's something about, she doesn't like the new stuff, but she likes the stuff that's recovered. So if you hear Goose, that's who that is.
It's okay.
Yeah, it's all right.
Dogs should be on the podcast, she's right,
allowed,
Goose?
Yeah, she's allowed to be in the podcast mm-hmm. studio. So, all right, so that's how we first met.
And for the record, we should cover this. You couldn't go that day.
Yes.
And so Schmitz and I and the good Dr. Shepherd braved the minus 10 and hiked in there and proceeded to climb 6 new pitches
Ugh.
On one day. And it was
still makes me sick.
And so, yeah, that was, it was a pretty cool day. I had good times with some rad people. I was a little bummed you couldn't come, but
yeah, me too. Me too.
So it's perhaps there's like a moral here or something.
There might be. There might be. Absolutely. There might be. And then but my favorite part of that story is that, so for one, you guys went way back in there where nobody had gone ice climbing before and put up this new route. And then you took a dump behind the first pitch.
It was at the end of the day. And after finally perhaps relaxing a little and perhaps... the fact that it was so cold, I finally relieved myself.
There you go.
maybe left a mark for anyone, any future suitors. Like, proceeded to write a trip report on good old CascadeClimbers.com back in the day, because I think this was before Facebook, or at least I was on there.
Yeah.
Because that was like the only way you could talk shit back in the day or make yourself look cool.
Yeah, it was before Instagram.
I think it was, what was it, Cascade Climbers and then all MontanaIce.com mm-hmm. with, do you remember whoever was ProRad?
Mm.
That was classic.
Yeah, I do remember that.
So, but anyways, posted the trip report and somebody then proceeded to call me out on...
Like
a week later.
Week later.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Who left that there? And it was like, mostly I was just amazed that someone had actually gone in there because they probably could have got the first ascent.
Yeah, that's
so
ridiculous. Like, yeah, nobody had ever been back there. And then literally a week after you go back in there, somebody, yeah.
What are you going to do?
Yeah, well, you learned you shouldn't take a poop.
Well, I think
5 miles in the middle of nowhere in the South Fork behind a pillar.
Yes, so. I learned my lesson.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, my word. So... Let's roll into a little bit of how you got involved with Jim Jones.
Oh, man.
Because we're rolling things way back now.
Good.
And if Mark Twight heard the words Jim Jones, he's probably like, he probably heard it. He's like, he twitched right now.
I hope he took a drink is what he did.
He probably did.
He deserves one. I'm taking one right now. We're going to go way back and probably further back than you want or frankly, most people listening to this, but at some point, I figured out that I liked climbing and that I wanted to, you know, do it as much as I could. It was my passion, which I think to make a bit of an assumption, I think most people listening to this, I know you definitely at some point had that moment where you're like, I love this. I want to do this as much as I can. With respect to perhaps other commitments I've made in my life.
Oh, yeah.
And
I was like 21 years old and I in Colorado and like, hey, I'm going to move to Cody, Wyoming. And all my buddies were like, I'm sorry, what?
Where?
Where? What are you doing? It wasn't for the social scene, obviously.
Yes.
But yeah, go ahead.
I can remember, like, I did a Knowles course out of high school. Kind of in the interest of not killing myself. And so, I'll backtrack a little further. Portland, Oregon, that's my home base. You can make fun of me for it. I do. It's not known for its alpine prowess.
Yeah.
Or frankly, anything except food carts and...
I mean, it's good food.
That's about it.
Yeah.
Oh, I heard it's a good place to meet potential wives, but we can get into that later.
Yeah, I mean, good food. Isn't it like the highest, like... Aren't there more strip clubs in like Portland than like
I wouldn't know. I feel like that would be a question for I mean Dr. Daedal.
That's what I heard. Voodoo Donuts. There's some other good stuff
there. Dude, we're digging. Yeah. It's not a place to it's not the best place.
I did meet my wife there, so I got that going.
You
for
got
me.
That.
Yeah.
And so did a Knowles course out of high school. And I can remember like standing on the Fremont Glacier below Mount Logan and looking across at Forbidden Peak and being like, oh my God, this is amazing. Like, and also thinking, man, Oregon sucks. Like, cause there's just so many mountains there and like just wanting to climb them all and just thinking like, this is so rad. And to like initially kind of, you know, in college kind of tried to look for a way. You know, because you're told like find a way to make your passion your employment. You know, like you hear that from people.
Yeah.
And so it was like, is there a way like I can get paid to climb because it's cool and I like it and you know, but also kind of thought because obviously everyone's like, well, be a mountain guide.
Yeah.
But there was some, you know, there was some.
That's probably the only legitimate like way to make a living, which is still marginal to be a climber. So.
I think, yeah, I don't know.
Unless you're Alex Honnold.
Yeah. I mean, there's, and it's changed so much in the time that I'm kind of sounding like an old guy, but how much has changed in the time that you and I have been doing it. Mm. Like, and I'm sure like even it, you know, in another 20 years, it'll look even more different.
Yeah.
But, figured out I loved climbing and kind of tried to build a life around doing it as much as I could while doing the other things I wanted to do in life, which is like have a career, have kids. And so definitely put climbing on the back burner during university, like in the interest of grades, like was like, yeah, it's either graduate or go climbing, pick one. And so kind of took a break from climbing, but which was kind of resulted in when I got out of university, kind of going all in on it, trying to like do it as much as I could. And as I did it more, started to realize, had some success and started to climb some stuff, harder stuff in Washington. Like also kind of started to realize like, oh, I like alpine climbing more than say rock climbing or the other disciplines, and really kind of started to try and look at like, where can I go with this? Like, cause there's that thing about climbing where you can kind of ask that question of like, am I good enough? Can I do this? If I'm not good enough, is there a way to change things about me so that I can be good enough? And I kind of have just applied myself to that question, which, you know, resulted in years later, me coming to the South Fork with Schmitz because being a good ice climber is a requirement if you want to do alpine climbing in Alaska. So,
So how did you, like, did you reach out to Martois? Like what happened?
Yes. I was like lost in the woods there. So in my quest to, so I can remember going to, like slideshows. Cause that was like the thing.
Oh yeah.
Back in the day to see like people share about their trips or whatever.
Now it's just movies. You gotta do a movie for you to get shown anywhere.
So back in the good old days, it was like come down and like tap the keg and listen to somebody tell, you know, slander and lies about their trip to wherever. And I can remember like going to like Colin Haley's slideshows at like Feathered Friends in Seattle. Like I'd drive up from Portland because it was Colin Haley.
Oh yeah.
He is a cool motherfucker and did some cool shit. I mean, from a young age. And just seeing these slideshows and be like, oh my God, Alaska looks so cool. Like, could I ever be good enough to go there? Or I remember like Joe Puyer and Mark Westman, like talking about some of their stuff and just being like, oh my God, that's so amazing. Like, I want to do that. Like, that looks so rad. But just also at the same time, like not knowing, could I, like I definitely at that moment not being good enough, but could I ever be good enough to do that?
Yeah.
And so that put me on kind of the quest to understand what it would take to do these things that looked that interested me. And so, I can remember, so anyone who climbs in Washington knows Selected Climbs in the Cascades by Jim Nelson. It's like the guidebook. And that was kind of like my to-do list out of university. Cause it like condensed, there's so much climbing in Washington and Jim has the best of the best in there. And one of the harder routes in that guidebook is a route on Mount Stewart called the Girth Pillar. And I knew that if I had goals to climb in Alaska, that the Girth Pillar should be not easy, but not hard for me. Like I should be able to do it in good style. And so I tried the Girth Pillar and I think my first year was either 03 or 04. I did it and did it in like the worst possible style, like bivvied, aided like all the pitches, not just the crux pitch, like, like barely made the summit and by sunset hiked down to the trail. I think we were like when you hit Ingalls Creek, you're like an hour from the trailhead. Okay. I was so destroyed. I like laid down in the dirt and slept. Like I just laid down and was like, I'm dead. And so getting my ass kicked on the Girth Pillar kind of put me on, it made me take a step back and say, okay, like I got to figure this out. I got to figure out how to get better in order to do the thing I want to do, which is climb in Alaska. And so that put me on this path of like, what do I need to change on the day to day to be able to move towards the goals that I have? And so that first, you know, another person, Marcus Donaldson, he was like,
Oh, Marcus.
He was like, hey, like they're opening this CrossFit gym in town and you know, we should go check it out. Like I've heard some stuff about it. Like
that's right. Cause that would have been right around the birth of CrossFit.
Yeah. And I mean, like, I think CrossFit Portland was like one of the 20th, it was like one of the first 20 CrossFits. And then this guy opened another, like, but it was way down in the other side of Portland and it wasn't worth the drive. And he only had like one session a week or something. Like it just wasn't conducive to me working where I worked. I had to like, there's just no way I could make the classes. And so when this other one opened, Marcus was like, they're opening this gym in North Portland. Like, let's go. And so I like signed up with Marcus and we started, cause he was kind of one of my partners at the time.
Yeah.
Basically trying to train for alpine climbing. And so first it was CrossFit and you know, you do that for a while and it's kind of cool. But then at some point you're like, well, wait a second. Like what is doing 100 pull-ups on Friday do for my climbing on Saturday? And how is this like, what about, and like when you just start to think for yourself, I suppose, and you ask these questions and you know, the guy gives you the like, oh, random tasks from the hopper excuse, you know, that they always yeah. love to throw. And so that kind of put me on the quest of like, well, how do people train for this stuff? And so that led me to Mountain Athlete, which I went to Rob Shaw's very first seminar he did in Jackson, Wyoming in 2008. I met Connie for the first time.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, she was there. She wasn't sleeping in her car because she still lived there. I was sleeping in my car. So I should backtrack. Sorry. God, you're going to have to edit all this.
It's all good.
So I did the Girth Pillar, got my ass kicked. I remember texting one of like my pro, I like basically reached out to like the best climber I knew at the time, which was Roger Strong.
Oh yeah.
And I was like, how do you train for this stuff? Cause like he had done stuff in Alaska. He had done some, he was doing hard stuff in Washington. I was like, Raj, what do you do, man? Like I know. Cause at the time he was still like doing the whole deadliest catch thing. Right. And so he had 9 months to like train and climb and be awesome. And I was like, what do I do? I don't know what to do. And I remember Raj was like, man, Steve House is here. And he's like on-siting all my stuff at the rap wall and he's super strong. And I don't know what he's been doing. And I think Twight's got this new gym in Salt Lake. I think he's doing that stuff. Like, but I don't know. And so like, I distinctly remember like getting on the internet, Googling Jim Jones or putting it in and finding that you know, that all black website,
oh, yeah,
you know, with like the blurry photos and the articles. And I was like, oh, what is this? And like, I remember, so I worked at a gear shop in high school in, growing up, like an outdoor store, and they had the Climbing and the Rock and Ice magazines. And if they didn't sell them, they had to like cut the name off, and then they could throw it in. They'd throw it in the break room. Yeah,
because you could get reimbursed if you sent back the
exactly. DPC. So they'd throw them in the break room. And I remember like on one of my breaks, like having like, you know, some crappy lunch and flipping through and finding Twite's Justification for an Elitist Attitude.
Oh boy.
And like reading it and being like, oh my God, this is amazing. Who is this? Like, I like punk rock too. This is awesome.
Oh my God.
And so I remember reading his stuff as a kid. Like, I mean, I was like 16, 17 maybe. And then kind of like not knowing about it, because university kind of just like, I lost track of Climbing because I was so focused on grades. And then getting out and hearing about from Raj, like Steve and Mark Twite and all this training. And so, I always knew about Jim Jones, but like, I never actually thought they didn't actually offer seminars until I think it was about 08, I think was when they first started.
It was like a private little gym. Like it was only invitation only. And
It was. And I definitely wasn't the first person there. Like there were a lot of people that went there before me. You know, the original crew were like a bunch of guys that were training jiu-jitsu with Mark's wife at the time. I mean, it was, and actually Jim Jones originally was like a CrossFit affiliate way back.
I didn't know that.
Oh man. Like there's a lot of history there that you can ask Mark about.
I will ask Mark about that next time. Yeah.
So, after Mountain Athlete in 08, definitely learned some stuff, got some insights into training, got some good.
And at this point you're working at Intel?
Still working at Intel.
Yeah, okay.
And so I started at Intel following my master's in 04.
Okay.
And, basically, you know, that was a big part of why I was trying to figure out how to do the things I wanted to do within the constraints of like a career. Cause Intel, literally it's like 3 weeks of vacation a year, full stop.
Yeah.
But 3 weeks.
That's
it. Can't
roll
it over. That's it.
Yeah.
And then we're going to like work you till you bleed. But I mean, like that's corporate America, right?
Oh yes.
So I had to like figure out a lot of this stuff, like essentially like trying to like hoard my vacation as much as possible. And, so I went to Mountain Athlete. And then, and Rob actually, he had mentioned, like he had been to, Rob Shaw had mentioned he had been to a Jim Jones seminar, and he was like, I didn't think it was so good. Like he kind of, I don't want to say shit talked him, but he just was like, I don't know if it's worth the money. And I was like, huh. And so I was like, whatever, I'm just going to go. Like, so yeah. I'm going to go, you know, this was someone inspired me as a snot-nosed teenager. Like, I just want to go. And so in 09, I went down there and met Mark for the first time, met Lisa for the first time, met Rob McDonald for the first time, and like just got just blown away. Just could not guzzled the Kool-Aid.
Oh, I was gonna say, I remember you were drinking. You were you were in the Kool-Aid. You weren't only drinking it, you were in it.
I was like, this is so good. Can I have seconds? Like it was, but I mean, it was so it, I was like, they were kind of known at that point because of 300.
Oh yeah.
But
cause that was Bitterman right after he had trained the actors for 300, right?
God,
right
around that time. I'd have to look.
I mean, that's kind of where things kind of blew up at that point. But anyways, yeah.
It was a whole bunch of Army Rangers that were there, like basically learning. And then there was me and, ironically enough, Russell Bergner, which if you're a CrossFit nerd, you would know he, over the years, rose to someone of importance at CrossFit and was later fired. But that's a whole story for another podcast. But, we were all there, and Mark literally both nights, like we would end at 5. He would like eat dinner and then he would stay and just keep talking about, he would basically stay and answer the questions of the military guys that were there. Like a lot of tier one guys, like how to train for stuff. Like, and I didn't presume to think that I was like supposed to stay and I was like going to leave. And they were like, no, yay, you should hang around for this. And so I literally left Salt Lake at like midnight on Sunday. And was just so energized. Like I drove, well, I had to drive straight back, but like drove straight back to Portland 12 hours and like went to work at 8.
Oh my God.
Story of my life. But it was amazing. And so sent them an email like 2 days later and was like, that was amazing. I learned so much. What about sports specific training? What about how do I apply this for climbing? Like just a bunch of like stuff of like, how do I use what you gave me with respect to the thing I want to do, which is climb in Alaska. And they were like, maybe you should come back this summer and private train with us. We'd love to explore this stuff with you. And I was like, sweet, let's do it. And so that kind of started the relationship with Jim Jones, which went on for years,
you know. Yeah, years. Oh. And what did it take? And I believe the term was disciple back then. And Mark may correct me at some point, but we'll call it the fully certified Jim Jones coach.
Instructor.
Was, yeah. What did it take to become the first certified instructor?
I'm laughing because I think that the standards have changed over the years.
I think they have.
but
back then, I remember you telling me what the standards were for some stuff, and I was just like, holy crap, man. And I mean, the row one, I remember the row. I mean, there was a bunch of them, but like, what did you have to go through in order to achieve that? Because it was over years, if I remember correctly.
Let Mark answer this one accurately when he's on the podcast. When I went in 2009, they actually didn't even offer a certification. It was just like, hey, come learn from us, which and that's what I did. Mark was kind enough, 'cause you want to talk about a busy person. He was kind enough to have coffee with me, and I asked him like Alaska and all these things about it and what would it take and am I good enough and what should I do? And, he gave me stuff then, and he continues to has just shared things or insights with me that, I think it's why he's such an amazing person to so many people. He, you know, as anyone who's met him and had even a small interaction with him or even not met him and read some of his writing, like the guy has an impact on people's lives.
Yeah.
And when he invited me to come back that summer to train with him, I was like, I will without a doubt come for that. And we did some private training that summer, and that's when they kind of mentioned, hey, we're going to start offering an intermediate and an advanced seminar. The very first intermediate was offered in 2010, which was at the time 3 days. Now I think it's a little shorter, but Mark's no longer affiliated with Jim Jones. Neither am I. And then they did the very first advanced seminar in 2011, which was 5 days. And back then, to even come to the advanced seminar, you had to like submit 6 months of training, that you'd done with athletes that you'd been coaching.
Oh yeah.
Like they really wanted to see that you actually kind of had a command of the material that you had learned in the fundamentals in the intermediate seminar, that you'd been applying the principles, not only in your training, but in the people you were coaching's training. I mean, like all of us can kind of self-coach to some success.
Yeah.
But that's just the tip of the iceberg. Like there's so much more to be able to like coach someone, and you had to, you know, really prove that you understood the mind was primary. It's whether it was in doing activities in the gym or whether it was activities out of the gym. But I don't know if I could accurately define what they required to certify someone other than I remember the way Mark would say it is that you were someone that they felt could carry their water, that could be trusted.
Okay. That makes sense.
Could be trusted to coach someone that was important to them, whether it be, you know, like I could, like if I were to go to Salt Lake and walk in and Mark was sick, I could cover the session for him and he'd be okay with that. Or he could trust to give me an athlete to coach and he wouldn't have to worry about it, which you know, like down the road, he asked me to work with Kyle Dempster for before he went to his trip. I don't remember what year that was. And so I think that's my best guess of what it means to be certified.
Okay. All right. I mean, that was, and it really, I mean, that connection with Mark and the gym is really kind of what I would say ignited the flame to your pursuits in Alaska.
Absolutely. Mark. So the first, when we had coffee, he, you know, I'm asking him all this stuff about Alaska and am I good enough and this and that. And Mark does this thing that he does. He looks at me and he goes, "You will never outperform your own self-image."
And it's so freaking true.
I know. I like sat there and I was like, what? I had to like unpack it in my head. And he, of course he knew that he'd like just mentally body slam me.
Yeah.
And so he like had to repeat it for me. Like, and he was like, "You'll never outperform your own self-image." And I was like, oh, and I still like reflect on that. Like it has such significance in not just climbing, but a lot of things.
Oh, yeah.
And, fast forward that year, 2009, when I first met him, went to Alaska for the first time with Doug Shepherd,
Mr. Shepherd,
Dr. Shepherd. I had never met in person. Like I was just so hell bent on like buying the tickets, doing the thing that, you know, I basically, someone I had swapped a couple messages with on the computer, like was like, "Hey, you want to go to Alaska with me? I'll buy your ticket." And so we went up there and we did two routes. Neither of them first ascents, but we did two routes. And that was like when it was clear to me, like, okay, I'm good enough to climb up here. Let's see how far we can take this. Let's see where we can go with this. And so that was my first trip. And then fast forward a couple months later, I did my second trip to Alaska in 2009 over 4th of July weekend and did my first ascent in Alaska, the West Ridge of Burkett Needle with Dave Burdick. And that started kind of my relationship with Jim Jones, but also really an effort to, you know, see what I could do in Alaska while still having the career at Intel and then also having a family.
Hmm.
So.
And so Burkett Needle was kind of the, I mean, was that the start to Smash and Grab? And like, how did that, cause most people are going to that area are going to go in for like, I mean, they're going in for several weeks.
So the Burkett Needle is located in Southeast Alaska. Near the Devil's Thumb. And so it's south of Juneau. And if you know anything about that area, if you've ever read any of the AAJ articles, or entries, you would know that it rains a lot.
Yeah.
Cause it's, and it's, the elevation is so low and its proximity to the ocean. It's just, it sucks.
Huh.
And it's the same reason why there's a whole lot of first ascents, even at this moment, as I sit here on this podcast, there is a lot of things left to be done. The guy who's kind of been the local mayor of the Stikeen Ice Cap is that, cause that's kind of the area.
Yeah.
Is this guy named Dieter Close. And he has devoted his whole life really to climbing the stuff there and has a lot of the first ascents. And, Dave Burdick had his eye on the West Ridge of Burkett Needle because of, this should be no surprise to anyone, Fred Becky.
Yeah.
Said, this, of course. This is unclimbed, pulled it out of like a dirty stack of papers. And so Dave had tried it, gone up there with Fred Becky, I think in 07, I want to say, or something. And kind of figured out that like whatever people had known, he just kind of was able to verbalize it, that like the weather windows are brief. You just have to be ready to grab them. And Dave was like, hey, I think we could just zip up there. Cause you know, Dave lived in Seattle. I lived in Portland. He was like, I think we can just zip up there if we see a good weather window. And I was like, yeah, sure. Like whatever. Like I didn't know. Cause I'd never been to Alaska at that point.
And you're still working at Intel. So you only have your certain amount of holiday or PTO to take.
Exactly.
So.
And so we actually agreed to go in 08, and there was no windows the entire year. Like that's how bad the weather is in the Stikine. It can just be crap. 09 rolls around, 4th of July weekend, you know, already some days off that don't count against your 3 weeks of vacation. Dave sees a weather window. He's like, I think there's a weather window. I think we could do this. And I was like, sweet, let's go. Fly up to Stikine. And we bump into Dieter at the airport, who's like, he's going in to do something else. And he's like, he looks at our like one duffel bag of his stuff. Cause we're like basically planning on two nights at most. And he's like, what? You guys think you can just smash in here and grab something? Like kind of made fun of us for it. And we were like, we don't know. Let's find out. So choppered in, did the West Ridge of Burkett Needle at, I think it was 5'8". Maybe 5'9", 5'8". Huh. Like I'd have to go back and look. Like that's how like 5'8" first ascents. Like,
yeah.
Like those don't exist unless the weather's bad most of the time. Yeah. And so we did the ridge. We came out, we did it in a 3-day weekend. And I was like, just assumed we were going to call it like the West Ridge of Burkett Needle. And Dave's like, we're calling it Smash and Grab. And oh so we'd use that name. And then it kind of came a running joke, but I don't think we realized it was a possibility until honestly a couple years later. Like it took a couple times of I had to convince myself it wasn't this fluke thing to actually believe it was like a possible way to pursue climbing in Alaska. And so 2010, didn't do any smash and grab, still went to Alaska, still did a new route on Mount Bradley. 2011 saw a weather window and did the second winter ascent of Mount Huntington. And at that point I kind of was like, I think this is something, I think I can use this to pursue climbing in Alaska without burning all my vacation every year. And cause if anyone has been to Alaska or has looked at the guidebook knows everything's like two weeks, 3 weeks, 4 weeks, like, and I don't have that. So,
yep. And no. Smash and Grab is born.
Let's be honest. I'm sure like Smash and Grab is just another way of saying like Alpine style, only we're going to consider the approach. Like we all climb stuff as fast as we can.
We're also going to consider your days you have to take off of work.
Yeah. Which okay.
Is really right. Important.
Yeah. But the idea of climbing something as fast as possible, like that's as old as Alpine style. We're just including the part of like, oh, I'm putting the out of office notice on at work.
Yeah.
I'm sprinting to Alaska and getting back as fast as I can before my boss notices that I left.
Yeah.
So.
But I think that, I mean, 90% of the people plus probably listening to this podcast have full-time jobs. And so like wrapping their heads around that, I could maybe do a couple of trips if the weather windows are there. And, you know, manage your family and daily life and all that stuff is pretty key. I mean, I remember hearing about you running up there, and I remember Doug called me. I was at work, and I was out of town. He called me on a Wednesday. He's like, hey.
Was this the Mount Huntington?
Yeah, it was the Mount Huntington. And yeah, he's like, hey, you want to go to Alaska this weekend? And I'm like, it's Wednesday, dude. What are you talking about? And he's like, dude, there's a weather window. And I'm like, I think so, you know. And
Alaska, this sounds different.
Totally. And next thing I know, I'm on like Friday night, I'm on a freaking flight. And the next thing I know, Saturday, I land on the glacier. And I think And then, let's see, it would have been Monday morning. We were flying out, I think, is what it was.
You guys were cooking too. You guys, like, from what I remember, you guys like landed and just started climbing.
Yeah, we landed, started climbing.
And then bivvied on route.
We set up the tent. Yeah. Bivvied on route, open bivvy on route on the Colton Leach. Top out at dark. And that was a whole nother story of Doug and I getting in an argument. Come down. I think we got to the tent at like 4 a.m. And then we got picked up at, I think, 10 a.m. the next morning. And I was out and I was on conference calls by freaking 2 o'clock the next day.
For the record, not everyone can do this. You do have to have a bit of a relationship, quality relationship, where if you've demonstrated to your pilot, and if you're going to Alaska, at least the Central Range, you should fly with Paul Roderick of Talkeetna Air Taxi, because he's the man. He actually climbs and can tell you if your route is in. I owe many first ascents to Paul. You know, if you show up first time in Alaska and say, I want to zip in and out, he might laugh at you. So pay your dues, I guess, is the moral of the story here. So
what's your most memorable smash and grab? Like, and memorable, maybe, and it doesn't necessarily need to be even the climbing. Like, what's the fastest even, I wonder? I'm going to ask a couple of questions. Right. What is the fastest smash and grab?
The fastest after, there was a few where I was able to go Portland to Portland in less than 48 hours. And that's a little bit because Portland, so Alaska Airlines.
Yeah.
Alaska, if you want to sponsor anyone, free miles, whatever, let me know. I'm always interested. Yeah, over here. They've got a red eye out of Portland that'll get you up there pretty late. There's actually two. You can then rent your car, drive to the Safeway in, God damn it, what's the town that Palin lives in?
Not Talkeetna.
No, not Talkeetna. We'll have to look this up.
Okay.
There, basically, you can like get everything done. So land in Anchorage at like midnight, get your rental car, go to the grocery store, get the food that you're probably not going to eat, but you should at least fly to the glacier with a little bit of food.
Yeah.
Drive up to Talkeetna, sleep in the TAT bunkhouse or on their floor because they're so nice because they're the best company there is. Paul rolls in around 8 usually. You should have all your stuff weighed and measured by then. Jump on the plane, fly in, spend one night there, and then climb the route the next day. And if you were fast enough on route, you can get back out and then catch a red eye back home. So, yeah, I did that once with Doug on Shaken Not Stirred on the Moose's Tooth. We did that 48 hours, Portland to Portland. I think Doug needed a little extra time to get back to, I think he was in Denver at the time. Doug and I did a first ascent in the Stikeen in sub 48 hours, partially because someone sitting here talking might have forgot the stove back in Portland.
Oops. Oh, that one minor thing.
Hey, it's like when you're rushing and you got all the stuff you got to throw in the bag. Like, that's the hard part about smash and grab is like, oh, we forgot something. We're already on the glacier. Like, it's like a fire drill, right? To get there. And so you're going to forget something. And sure enough, I forgot the stove. And credit to Doug, who's put up with many mistakes I've made over the years for not throwing me in a crevasse on the spot for forgetting the stove. And so we had cold coffee, which made it an epic in my book. And we like somehow got water off like the melted glacier.
Oh my God.
So yeah. So 48 hours there. What else? I've got most of the trips have been like 3 days.
Okay.
Like
bivvy, which is pretty. Yeah.
Yeah. Which that's is still,
pretty, that's pretty quick.
That's like, you know,
and especially if you're doing it over the weekend, you're only talking about one day off.
Well, and if you're really good, at least when I was at Intel, which is probably I'm no longer at Intel, you just sneak out early on Friday or air quotes work from home.
Oh yeah, because then that could put you
put you
on the glacier Saturday morning because
you're still answering emails while you're on the plane up to Anchorage.
Okay.
I definitely work the system, But this was all before everyone got like working from home.
Yeah, now it might even be simpler if you have a work from home job. Yeah,
now and nowadays, like people can get these satellite modems and just work from the glacier.
Well, yeah, if you got Starlink, you could actually be sitting on the glacier.
See, yeah, exactly. Like, so kids these days
done that.
Probably. I mean, I've seen, you
just
see
need a power, some power. I mean, it doesn't suck a lot of power either. So I'm sure.
There you go.
Probably same. Denali Base Camp's probably got Starlink, I'd imagine. So,
well, that's a whole nother.
Yeah, it's another situation.
Circus over there.
So, obviously, smash and grab, the most like key element is understanding how to read weather.
Weather, so where did you, weather and conditions.
Weather like, and conditions.
You like, just because it's a weather window doesn't, like, sure, it can be blue skies and sunny, but that doesn't mean it didn't snow 10 feet the day before. Mm. And so you have to be tuned in to like what is happening in the area that you're interested in. And it's no different than coming to the South Fork.
Yeah.
You know, like if you're looking at the weather forecast every morning and just keeping track of like, oh, has it been cold? Has it been hot? Have they had snow? Like what's going on? You can pretty quickly kind of get a sense of what are the conditions going to be? Doesn't mean 100%, but you can at least make some assumptions. And the best way to learn it is like find someplace local that you can go to all the time. Like for me, it was Mount Hood, and I could just read the weather forecast and then go up there and experience what was the forecast? Like what was partially cloudy? What was 30% chance of snow? Hmm. What like, 'cause you got to learn kind of what the meteorologist means in the forecast.
Yeah.
And then correlate that to like what actually happened.
Huh.
And if you just, you know, instead of looking at Instagram every morning, like look at the stupid gram, but also look at the weather so you can actually go understand what's going on. Turns out there's a lot of really good webcams in this world where you can actually see.
Oh yeah.
Like there's a, so there's a public radio station in Stikine, Alaska that points across the bay at the Devil's Thumb, and it's continuously updated. And so you can look at the forecast and then you can look at the webcam.
Oh really?
And you can like literally start to learn what it means to be partially cloudy.
Huh? So are you like, if somebody was looking to go to do a smash and grab, say in whatever we'll call May mm-hmm. this year, are you looking at the weather even starting in January? Like, are you consistently looking at the weather leading up to that time? Or are you saying, well, I know this route's usually in May, so then start of May, end of April, you start looking at the weather?
If they want to smash and grab, it depends a little on the route. Like, I'm ducking your question a little here. But, like, let's say somebody wanted to smash and grab the French Ridge of Mount Huntington. Which that's something I smash and grabbed. I know the crux of that route is going to be the deep snow and the double cornices.
Yeah.
So I want to do it in a year where it's a low snow year. And I want to do it in a time of the year where either all the snow is melted and consolidated, so late season, or before it's gotten all its snow and the cornices have gotten big, which is exactly what I did.
I was going to say, you did it early, right?
I did it
because it was considered a winter ascent, wasn't it?
Yeah, we did. It was, ironically enough, after a decade at Intel of sneaking out early to go climb in Alaska on my last day at Intel, which was February 28th, I snuck out early at lunch, and I think I missed my going away party.
Oh my God.
To fly to Alaska and do the first winter ascent of the French Ridge of Mount Huntington.
In February.
February 28th, so March 1st. But yes, and yes, it was very cold. Very.
And that was a light snow year.
Well, I think it was a normal snow year, but what they hadn't had yet was their like spring snow.
Oh, okay.
And so Alaska will get dumps of snow, but then it will also have big wind events, much like Cody, where all that new snow gets removed.
Yeah.
And so if you watch long enough, you'll see like, oh yeah, there was a big snow event, but there's also been a lot of clear weather and or high wind, and a lot of that snow got removed. So I had a suspicion the route was in. I then emailed the best person in the world, Paul Roderick, and said, hey, Paul, how does the French Ridge look? And Paul, Well, because he loves flying, I think, more than anything, flew out there and took a picture for me and sent it to me and said, when are you coming?
Oh my God.
Because I had asked him so many times about it and I hadn't come. And I was like, shit, I got to go. Because it looked perfect. Huh. And it was. It was like we did not post hole at all.
Really?
Which is good because it still took us forever to climb that thing. It was like bivvied at 10,000 feet. And then we had a 16-hour day only to hit the summit. And so we had to bivvy at 12,000 feet, whatever that is in meters for your,
yeah,
your European followers, on March 1st in Alaska in winter.
Wow.
And it was probably one of the colder nights I've had. So, but we did first winter ascent.
And no frostbite.
No frostbite.
Wow.
No frostbite. And my second, here's the stupid part. It was my second time climbing Mount Huntington in winter. You'd think I would have got enough fill the first time, yeah, but I went back a second time.
That's just,
so
that sounds horrible. What was the first route?
2011, I did the West Face Couar, which was the second winter ascent of Mount Huntington. The first winter ascent of Mount Huntington was Mr. Colin Haley and another badass, Jed Brown.
Oh, yeah. I haven't heard of Jed Brown in a while.
It's because he's too busy doing cool stuff in Boulder. I think that's where he's at. I don't know. Huh. You might have to edit that out.
Yeah, probably is.
But
they did some cool stuff back then.
They did the first. And frankly, like that was like, they did that in I think 08. Like they did it before I'd ever been to Alaska. And they did it over Colin's spring break. So instead of Colin going to Mexico. For whatever college students do, he went to Alaska to climb with Jed. And they did, and the weather was good. And so they were like, let's go in. Let's see what happens. And they did the first winter ascent of Mount Huntington.
Wow.
And I remember thinking like, wait, Colin only had a week and he still climbed something in Alaska. Maybe there's something here.
Yeah.
And so, you know, credit to all the people before me that, you know, figured it out.
Yeah.
I was not the guy that invented smash and grab.
You just came up with the term.
I think Dieter Close did. when he was mad.
True, yeah.
He was pissed that we only had
You think you're going to come and smash and grab?
Exactly. He was like,
oh my God.
And we had like two eggs. We had like a box of spaghetti. I don't know. Like we didn't have anything.
Yeah.
And he had like provisions for like a month.
For a month. I'm going in.
Yeah. So.
So what advice would you have for the guy that was in that similar situation? He has got 2-3 weeks of vacation only. And has never done smash and grab. Like, I mean, where do you start? Like, you know, just a quick summary of that. Like, where does that guy start?
Man.
I mean, fitness has got to be one, right?
Fitness absolutely has to be one thing. You need to. So fitness is the ability to do a task. And the fitness to climb M9 looks different than the fitness to do multi-pitch routes in the South Fork.
Yeah.
They're similar, but they're different.
Yeah.
The fitness to climb in Patagonia, where it's not as cold. There is some ice climbing, but it's different than the ice climbing you would get in Alaska. There's less snow. The fitness for that is different than the fitness to climb in Alaska. And the more accurately you can define your fitness goal, the thing, the why, the what you're doing, the what you're training for, the more accurately you can then define your training plan to prepare for that. Hmm. If you can. So for me, and why I have loved Cody so much, I know we've done a podcast before talking about how this place is the Alpine Simulator.
Yeah.
For like, if you can climb hard here, if you can get tough here, you're probably going to do pretty good in Alaska.
Yeah.
Doesn't mean you're set for it, but paying your dues here, paying your dues in other places is going to set you up for success there. And so, with that in mind, we have to take a step back and say, okay, the fitness required to be successful in Cody requires a certain training program. Like you could be aerobically very fit. You could have an amazing aerobic threshold, but if you can't climb your way out of a paper bag,
yeah,
you know, you're gonna get crushed in the South Fork. You'll be the fastest guy on the approach.
Yeah.
But you're then gonna get crushed by the first pitch.
Yep.
And so it's understand being able to understand what are the attributes I need for the goal, then shapes the training plan. But the training plan is shaped by where you are and what strengths and weaknesses you have as an athlete.
Yeah.
And that's why there's no such thing as one size fits all. Everyone comes to, you know, everyone brings in who they are as well as what they've done historically as an athlete. And that shapes what they need to work on based on the goal. Like a great example, triathletes, they do a lot of heart rate training to be able to do triathlons. And so their aerobic threshold is really good. However, they also do only body weight stuff. It's swim, bike, run.
Oh yeah.
They don't carry anything. And so we've had, you know, in my coaching profession, I've worked with people that came to me from the triathlete world that had amazing aerobic thresholds or the ability to use fat to produce ATP to fuel metabolism, muscle function. These same people get crushed by the pack. And so their program looks very different than the person that maybe doesn't have a good aerobic threshold, but has been climbing for years and years and years. And to take it maybe a step further, a good example would be, even if you and I said, hey, we're going to go climb, you know, some new route in the Stikine that I know about that we're not going to talk about on the podcast because I don't want to get scooped like you. and we evaluate us. And even though we have the same exact goal, our training plans look different. Like yeah. Your technical skill is so much better than mine. Like I need more technical work in my program to make my weaknesses less weak. And you, because you're already over horsepowered in one area, your technical skill, maybe you would need more aerobic work. Maybe not. Let's be honest, you're a badass. But like,
I mean, I am in the South Fork, so I'm pretty good on the aerobic side.
Yeah,
but still.
But
if you're in Colorado or you're in these other places, I mean, South Fork's one of the few places where aerobic and ice climbing are pretty heavy. Exactly. Like they're pretty equal with each other.
It's why when, you know, Doug is probably one of my best partners for like all my Alaska stuff. I think I did like 5 ascents of my trips up there with him, maybe more. Like Doug was always the better technical climber. Yeah. Always. Like, and so if the goal is the summit, give the hard pitches to the guy who's better and is going to do them faster. And give the heavy bag and the snow slogging to the dude that can deadlift a whole bunch,
yeah.
You know, like, you know, it's not about ego. It's about the team there.
Yeah.
Like, cause if you can get rid of your ego and get up the route, you have a better chance of making the summit. And
yeah.
So where was,
well, you're definitely working to each other's strengths versus, typically, yeah, you go to that, everybody equals their pack. I mean, yeah, you might have a leader's pack, but in your guys' case, you were also block climbing. Like,
yeah.
So Doug would do the hard stuff, and then you'd come up with the rear with all the heavy shit. And you guys would pick routes that also probably worked
for
to
style,
that
yep.
style.
Exactly.
Which is really key. Instead of just picking a route that you're like, oh, that's a really cool route, I want to go do that. You guys were doing that, yeah. But you were also like, this one's more our style.
You're totally right. I was going to say occasionally it's okay to want to do the thing that looks cool.
Yeah.
Like that's okay. Like I want to someday climb the Moonflower Buttress. I want to. I haven't tried it yet. I'd sure love to see if I could be the first person who smashed and grabbed it, but we'll see.
Yeah.
You know, we'll see.
Huh?
You know, I at least, and this would be arrogant to assume that I'm the all knowing, all seeing person, but as far as I know, no one has on-site smash and grabbed anything on Mount Hunter. Maybe the West Ridge, but like
yeah.
No one's done anything on the Moonflower first try. So, or smash and grabbed it. So to the summit.
Yeah. And I remember, I believe too, that I remember you started like with very attainable goals when you're doing smash and grab. Like, you never really went too far. Like, it was almost like you built a base, you learned it, you figured it out, and then you started going after, like, after you'd built this really good base, then you started going after harder or more technical or deeper range type mountains. But you definitely seemed to, like, build this base, which probably also built confidence that you could go do the other stuff.
Absolutely. Just like how you would climb in the South Fork, you know, yeah. Like, let's do a four the first day. Let's, you know, I've heard about these Cordy grades. Let's find out. Let's find out if they're actually sandbagged or not. I climbed sixes in Colorado. Let's, you know.
Yeah. So, and I never had to throw a tool.
Yeah. Well, yeah, shots fired. But so, like, I think, so my first smash and grab was Burkett Needle in 2009. And then fast forward to 2011, it was the West Face Couar on Huntington, which had been done before by Colin and Jed in winter. I specifically talked to them. I also talked to Mark Westman, who's, like, the man when it comes to Alaska. You know, what do you think of the conditions? Like, I think it's this. I've been watching. It hasn't snowed for 3 weeks. I think it's good to go. And then also knowing that, okay, the first pitch is four and then it's a bunch of water ice three. I know I can do that in my double boots because I've done it in double boots in the South Fork when it was minus 10. I think I can do this. And so, because if you don't, if you stick your neck out too much on the first try, like, you know, we know how that can go.
Yeah.
And so I was very cautious, and it wasn't until 2012 where I did three smash and grabs in 1 year, did a new route on the northeast face of Mount Dickey with Doug. No such thing as a bargain promise. I did the new route on the south face of Wake with Jess Ross Kelly that October. And then 2 weeks later, went to the Stikine with Doug and did a new route on the northwest face of Mount Burkett.
Huh.
And so, and then that was the same year I got certified by Jim Jones. And so, cashed in all the chips.
Yeah, year. I was saying you cashed it all in.
2012 was a good year. Yeah.
Done.
2012 was a good year.
Damn. So, and so, what are you doing now? You're no longer working for Intel. Oh, you quit doing that years ago.
Let's see. I left Intel in 2014. I don't know if we should go into that. That's a whole nother.
Yeah, we probably don't need to go there.
I would violate my NDA anyways. Yeah. We'll say this. I got interested in coaching, and I had the opportunity to leave Intel and make this thing that initially I tried to figure out for myself, you know, how to build the fitness to do the things I wanted to do. There were so many people involved in that. Like, we talked about Mark Twite, but there was also Mark Westman. There was Roger Strong. There was my training partners. There was all these people that I learned from to kind of figure out what recipe it took for me to do these things I wanted to do. And I enjoyed it. Yeah. And I wanted to, I was given by some, I still don't know how it happened, but some way was given the opportunity to leave Intel to be a coach, and I've done that since. Like, I'm still to this day coaching, that person that basically gave me the opportunity to leave Intel.
Yep.
And in, what was that? 2000, I think it was 2015, Training for the New Alpinism was published. And actually, so rewind back to 2010. Went down to Jim Jones for a seminar and to assist at one, because I was doing a lot of, like, learning, because their seminars were so dense, like, tons of material. So I'd go down there as much as I could to just be there and soak up everything I could learn. And that's where I met Steve House for the first time. So, you know, met one of my childhood heroes, Mark Twite there. 2010, met Steve House there. I remember doing tailpipe with him. And I was so excited to do it that I was pulling, like, 120 on the rower. God. I mean, I was just like, I like lit myself on fire.
I bet.
And I remember Mark walking over and looking at my monitor, my PMT, and he was like, he looked at me and he's like, "What you doing?" Like, like he just was like he just he knew I knew better. He, yeah. he was just like, "What the fuck are you doing?" And I was like, I remember looking at him and I was like, maybe if I row fast enough, Steve will go to Alaska with me. And Steve was holding his kettlebells in the rack position because that's tailpipe, you know? Yep. And he started laughing so hard he almost dropped his kettlebells. Because he was like, I'm not going to Alaska with you, kid. Like, who are you? Like, and I don't, like, I wouldn't have gone to Alaska with me either. But, like, it was totally hilarious. And
My God.
It's funny to me. But
yeah,
fast forward. 2015, Training for the New Alpinism came out. I actually sent, or maybe it was 14, somewhere in there, it came out and I was like, hey guys, do you want to do a seminar in Portland? Like, I think that what you wrote in that book is amazing. I think there's a lot of stuff that would help people. It, you know, I had to learn a lot of this stuff on my own without a book. Like, do you want to come do a seminar? And Steve and Scott were like, maybe? Like, I don't know. Do you think we could actually make it worth our time? Like, cause you know, they had to travel to Portland. There's a lot of cost. And so I convinced them to do it and we sold that thing out, like sold it out. And they came and did a seminar and I, you know, that's where I met Scott for the first time. And we did everyone that came, we did a lactate threshold test on them. And so I spent a day like doing finger pricks on people, like measuring lactate with Scott and met Scott and was, I knew who Scott was, but I'd never met him. And I was like, wow. Like, you want to talk about a smart dude, like unbelievable. The depth of knowledge with that guy. And it was awesome. And I think they went on to basically found Uphill Athlete sometime after that. Cause the seminar was before.
Yeah.
And they started their thing and, you know, stayed in contact, but not really. And then a few years later, they were like, hey, John, like, would you consider coaching for us? And I still had my kind of other business that I was doing. And I was like, yeah, you know, I think I could coach a couple athletes for you. And so I started coaching for them like almost 5 years ago. And at some point they one of the coaches there, cause they just kept growing and growing and growing.
Yeah.
One of the coaches there, Sam Nini, they kind of put him in charge of, he was the, coaching director, kind of he had some responsibilities that essentially Steve and Scott couldn't handle, which was like matching incoming athletes with coaches, kind of in a lot of ways, supervising a lot of the coaches there. And Sam left in 2020, I want to say. And so they asked if I wanted that role and I took that role over in I think 2021. And so I was the coaching director for them for about a year.
Okay.
So.
And now it is
changed. I feel like this is where we should tell.
We've already covered this one in another podcast.
Yes, but people should go back and listen. If they haven't already, listen to the Scott Johnston podcast.
Yeah, for multiple reasons. One, that Scott, like you said, is wicked freaking smart when it comes to this stuff.
Do you want to talk about someone that not only was basically an Olympic level athlete, almost went to the Olympics himself?
Yeah.
But more importantly, because let's be honest, like there are people that are good athletes that are not good coaches. Just because you had success in your sport does not mean you know what it takes to coach someone else.
Yeah. It's just like I say, not all good climbers are good coaches either. So when it comes to teaching clinics or whatever it might be,
Aaron. Amen.
Yeah. I mean, my wife would say I'm not a good coach. That's for darn sure. So
We got to make sure and talk about her.
Yeah. We might have to save that one for another one.
Oh, but man.
Yeah. How that happened. So you're now at Evoke Endurance. You're working with Scott, and you're also the
director of coaching.
Director of coaching for Evoke Endurance.
I'm doing the same thing let's be honest. Like 15 of 17. I think it actually changed to 16 of 18. But like,
oh.
Like the number went up since I think the podcast. Oh, but okay. What uphill was left? The people that made uphill athlete great, all those coaches that were coaching all those people, they all left. So you might as well call Evoke uphill, but we can't obviously because
yeah.
Steve purchased the rights to the name. So, but all the people that were in the trenches doing the coaching every day, helping all these athletes achieve their goals, helping these building custom programs specific to people's goals, they all left with yeah. Scott and they are no longer there, including myself.
Yeah, that makes sense. I'm sure it wasn't an easy decision. And I feel like I've now done a couple of podcasts on this subject. So Steve, if you're listening and you want to tell your side of the story, I'm all ears. But I know you for a long time, and I know obviously what you've put into becoming a coach and the training and the value you've put there, and it is your career. And I think that says a lot for you as a coach, but also the decision that you made here. So, yeah. I feel like we covered some pretty good stuff here. The only thing we didn't cover is like how in the world you introduced me to my wife. And I think I got to almost like save that one for another time because we're already like almost over an hour and a half here. We'll save that one for another time, but. The gist of it is I won my wife. Just leave it at that.
Should we name some names?
Well, there was a certain individual with a certain pack company. Your
best, worst sponsor ever is what we'll say. You know Graham. Who you are. Oh, you Graham. Said his name. All right. It's out of the bag. Oh,
we love Graham. I mean, he also married me. So, I mean, I love the guy. So
bless his heart.
Bless his heart. Yep. All right, man. Well, John. Really appreciate you jumping on here. John happens to be rolling through town with his wife and getting some days in the South Fork. I think you did what? You're on day three yesterday? Or is that day two?
Yesterday was day three.
Day three.
Today was a tad chilly, so we didn't get out.
I mean, the high of negative 10 today, and I think tomorrow's high is negative 17. Sounds like a rest day to me.
I don't know. There might be some FAs left somewhere.
Yeah, but not on negative 17.
Well, I'm happy to get on here only because if it weren't for you and it weren't for your generosity over the years and your perpetual stoke and no one has done more for the South Fork, which kind of by extension, like I wouldn't have done that stuff in Alaska had I not come here, and I hadn't come here if it had been for, you know, back in the day, what was it? Cold Fear Blogspot.
Yeah.
Was that what? Like that. Yeah. Yeah. And so like, it's the people need to recognize how much, if they don't, they should take a step back and recognize like how much you've given to so many people to come to such a great place. And so I'm grateful for everything you've done. And, you're an awesome dude, Aaron Mulkey.
Well, God, I don't know that I can respond to that. So
you don't need to.
I really appreciate it. And I hope everybody enjoyed the conversation here. Thanks, John.
Cheers.
Cheers.